Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Right now on Last Call, lights, camera, drama. There's a huge shakeup in the works at Paramount. We got the fast-moving development out of whack. It's something that's only happened once before in 34 years, but it just happened again. I'll tell you what that is. Raked over the coals. How a big move by the EPA could jack up what you pay for electricity. Call it a Herb alert. Herb Greenberg sounding the siren on one big diamond company. He'll be here to make the case. Fork it over. Congestion pricing, getting an official start date in New York City. Is it soon coming to a city near you? And
release. Oh my gosh, it's falling, it's falling. No, 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 don't hit that, don't hit that. All right, here it is. Moment of truth.
How can iPhones survive a fall from the sky, but not your kitchen counter? Joanna Stern joining us with the report you have to see. All that and more across the hour. Belly up or buckle up. Last Call is up right now. Well, good evening here. Good afternoon out west. Hope you're having or just had a great Friday wherever you are. I'm Brian Sullivan. All that and more coming up in our hour. But first up on Last Call, very quietly and very suddenly, the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ just had their best weeks of the year. Strong earnings from Alphabet today and Microsoft today helping them boost and rocket the stock market. In fact, Google, Alphabet, had its best day in more than 8 years, finishing up 10%. Investors in Microsoft got a nice 2% pop as well. NVIDIA got its groove back on all the AI excitement, rising 15% this week. It basically added a Honeywell in market cap since Monday. And all in all, the so-called Magnificent Seven added about $464 billion in market value today. For context, that is more than the combined market caps of Netflix and Disney. The earnings abundanza continuing next week with some little companies you might have heard about. Amazon, Apple, McDonald's, and many, many more. Now, if that was not enough, next week you've got a Federal Reserve meeting and a jobs report as well. So there's a lot going on. And few better to talk about this and something interesting in the currency market with famed hedge fund manager Kyle Bass, founder and chief investment officer of Hayman Capital Management. Kyle, I love that. I'm just going to talk to you about the stock market. It's amazing. I feel like the Kyle Bass of 2007 is back with us, my man. What do you make of what's happening in the stock market? And it's not just us. The whole world is reinflating. Why?
Well, I mean, Brian, it all goes back to the difference between nominal and real, right? When you think about what happened with the Fed expanding its balance sheet, you just remember, you brought up 2007. In 2007, the Fed's balance sheet wasn't even $1 trillion, meaning it hadn't expanded or created, basically created less than $1 trillion over a multi-decade period. Then from 08 to 2018, 2019, it went from $1 trillion to $4.5 trillion. And then it went from $4.5 trillion to $9 trillion in 18 months. And so what the Fed, the Treasury, and Congress has done is take inflation to new levels. We all know, like, the government's own FHFA housing index in the last 3.5 years is up 50%, Brian. So when stocks are ripping, you have to remember that all that money that got printed ended up in rich people's hands, and rich people are the ones who own stocks. And so in the end, the stock markets typically in great rounds of inflation keep up with about 85% of the inflation. And that's what we're seeing. So, you know, we don't need too many self-congratulatory pats on the back. We're just trying to break even on inflation.
Yeah, it's a good point. And we've talked about it, that this economy is two economies, right? Forget, everybody wants to fight red, blue, right? Democrat, Republican, who cares? Let's talk green. I think the real divergence in America is asset owners and asset renters. If you're an asset owner, stocks, a house, whatever, you're doing great. If you're an asset renter because you can't afford those things, your wages are going down and you're really struggling. I completely understand and get that. And you wonder, what does the Federal Reserve do? We talk, Kyle, about interest rates. Will the Fed raise interest rates? Will they lower interest rates? Whatever. Let's not forget, they've got quantitative easing and quantitative tightening as well, and a balance sheet that is almost double the size, call it 1.5, of the entire federal budget. I mean, the Federal Reserve is running the show.
Federal Reserve is running the show. And unfortunately, what they just taught Congress is we have your back no matter what. And what I mean by that is, just remember last year, our government brought in about, 4.4 trillion of receipts and spent 6.1 trillion. We ran a 40% of receipts deficit at full employment. We just went full crazy. And, you know, we wonder when these deficits are going to stop. We don't run deficits that are 7% of GDP or 40% of revenues at full employment. You normally run those deficits when you're countercyclically spending to turn around a recession. So I don't know what the Fed's doing now. But Brian, they just moved the price level. In my view, if you look at the price of milk, the price of soda, the price of housing, look at the price of the things we consume, and you don't chain weight them. Don't do what the BLS and the Fed does. We just moved the price level from 100 to 150 over a 3.5 year period. And when you see the inflation numbers die down, you'll see, do you think if you raise rates 550, 600 basis points that you can get a year over year number to lap at plus one or zero? Of course you can. We're going to see that soon. And they're going to be self-congratulating, and they're going to say, we tamed that inflation dragon, but the new price level is 150. And so, to your point, inflation disproportionately affects the poor and the lower middle class. And I believe that's why we're seeing society and society's bonds tear. That's why we're seeing.
And it drives me insane. And by the way, it'd be the same if it was the red team or the blue team. I don't care. I'm not on any team. OK, when I hear ostensibly smart politicians say inflation is coming down. OK, I get it. They didn't take an economics class. The rate of inflation is coming down. But to your point, inflation is not coming down. That's prices go down. That's deflation, or that tends to be a problem where if prices go from 10 to 15 and 15 to 16, like, oh, we won in the battle against inflation because inflation is coming down. No. You were paying 10 a couple years ago, paying 16, and you were paying 15. So the rate has slowed down, but you're still paying a lot more. And I don't know what the Fed can do about it, Kyle. I don't know what the Federal Reserve can do about things like the prices of houses or car insurance or things like that, where the median home price or median home payment in America is now basically double what it was 4 years ago.
Yeah, Brian, that's a great point. The price of shelter is key to the entire equation. And if the Fed doesn't allow regular business cycles to happen, you get what we just got, inflation. And you also have to go to the next step. And the next step is basically every commodity around the world is priced in dollars. We have 18 people that set monetary policy for the U.S. that are unelected. They're all appointed. And they really don't answer to anyone. And they actually run monetary policy for the world. And what I mean by that is we set dollar rates for dollar prices for just about everything because we are, again, the world's most important economy. And yet everyone else in the world has some kind of negative convexity to what we just pushed to them. We just pushed massive inflation to the rest of the world. And now Japan is really struggling with dealing with balancing on balance sheet 250% debt to GDP versus trying to raise rates a tiny bit to maybe turn the yen around, but the yen's just flapping in the wind. Just think about this. If you're a Japanese saver and all your money was in yen, you've lost half your money in the last 3 years. You've lost half of it. It's pretty crazy.
We did not talk before this interview. And I want people to know that I had no idea you were going to go there because my next question is actually about Japan. And you talked about Japan. The yen is crashing. Okay. We're showing a yen to dollar chart on there. It's the lowest level since 1990. The Japanese stock market in US dollar terms is at a high since 1990. EWJ has rocketed higher. I think I remember you years ago telling me that you changed your mortgage to yen from U.S. dollar. Is that true? I don't know if that's true or if you still have
it. It was true.
Yeah, but is Japan a risk or a warning to others? To your point, we're exporting inflation. It's good for us here, but at some point, I feel like something could break. I don't know.
Well, I think, again, if you look at the currencies of the troubled nations of the world, if you look at the Argentinas, and I'll mention a few, Lebanon, if you look at Turkey, if you look at Iran, Iraq, if you look at their value, the value of their currencies in dollars has either hyperinflated or dramatically lost value. And so when someone like Japan, one of the anchors of the Asian economies, loses 50% of their purchasing power, it also means Japanese exports are much more competitive now than Chinese exports. So what does this do? This puts enormous pressure on countries like China, like Hong Kong. Hong Kong's pegged to the dollar, for heaven's sake. And historically, our economies moved in a synchronous way, and now they're moving in two different directions. And so things like that, you said things are going to break. I think you're going to see a pretty material Chinese devaluation, and I think you're going to see the Hong Kong dollar break the peg at some point in time in the future.
Wow. And currencies, they don't talk about them enough. They're massive. It's the biggest, most liquid market in the world, and there is a lot going on under the hood. You make us smarter, Kyle, even when you join us from what appears to be a mid-market hotel in Dayton. So we appreciate it, and tell the good people at Hilton Garden Inn we said thank you. Kyle Bass, thanks very much. Appreciate that. All right. Let's take a look at our stud and dud of the week. The big winner this week, ResMed. People apparently buying a lot of those CPAP machines, the big decliner. Trucking company Old Dominion Freight Lines down about 14% on weakening demand. Transports, pay attention. All right, we got a lot to do. On deck. Sleeping with the fishes. Somebody call Luca Brasi. A big shakeup could suddenly be afoot at Paramount. Plus, $100 just to drive into New York City from New Jersey. It's about to happen as a big new toll gets slapped on many New Yorkers.
Selling smoothies is what I do, but for small business insurance, I chose my State Farm agent. He's a small business owner, too, so he knew how to help me personalize my policies. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to an agent today.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes has arrived in IMAX.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Now playing only in theaters. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
All right, time for TNT. Some of the headlines and stories you and Wall Street will be talking about tomorrow or Monday morning. First up, you may be streaming more NBA games soon, according to The Athletic. The NBA and Amazon Prime Video are the framework of a deal that will make the streaming service home to one of the main areas for the NBA. It's expected that Prime Video's package will include significant regular season and postseason games. Some conference finals may also be a part of that deal. And in a new twist in the Paramount saga, according to the Wall Street Journal, the company's board is considering replacing CEO Bob Bakish and installing a committee of top execs to run the company, at least on an interim basis. This comes as Paramount and Skydance inch toward a merger. Joining us now is the author behind that report, Jessica Tunkel. She is the Journal's deputy media editor. Jessica, great scoop. Does Bob Bakish have a job on Monday morning?
So I think yes. Bob has to do earnings after the market close on Monday, so I do believe he'll still have a job on Monday, but I don't know how much longer he will be in his position.
What's the problem here?
So my sources have told me that tensions between Sherry Redstone, who is the controlling shareholder of Paramount, and Bob Bakish have been increasing quite a bit over the past several months. Sherry and the board have not been happy with some of the decisions Bob has made in managing the company. One of those is his decision not to sell Showtime. We reported last year that there have been a number of offers for Showtime, including one a couple of years ago that was as high as $6 billion that Oof. They turned down. So this has been brewing for a while, and it's kind of all coming to a head now.
$6 billion for Showtime sounds pretty good these days, doesn't it?
Yeah, right? Especially when the market cap of the whole company is around $8.5 billion.
Yeah, and it also, it sounds like from your reporting and also some add-ons from Alex Sherman on our side here last night, that Sherry Redstone just wants to get a deal done, take some billions out of it. I mean, get a deal done at any, right? Just no matter what the obstacle is. It sounds like Sherry is going to get a deal done because she's going to make billions.
I think Sherry would like a deal done. I don't know if the Skydance deal is going to be the deal that happens. But yes, I think she is ready to at least sell National Amusements, which is what the entity through which she owns, she controls Paramount.
All right. Good stuff. Really appreciate it. Great scoop. We're going to tweet it out. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Take care. Have
All
a good
right.
one.
All right. You okay. too. Thank you. All right. For more reaction to the Paramount saga, let's bring in Laura Martin, Managing Director, Senior Internet and Media Analyst at Needham, also Hollywood superstar in her own right, probably knows many of these players personally. Do you have a hot take on what we just heard, Laura?
This is the worst idea ever. First of all, you should get a deal done first and let the buying company decide what happens to the senior management team. Secondly, Brian, who's ever heard of a company run by committee? So you're going to do a deal with Tom Cruise and he has to talk to five people on the committee that's going to replace Bob Bakish. I mean, that's a silly idea. And they don't have a succession plan in place. That's a silly idea. And why aren't they doing the Apollo deal where actually public shareholders get as much as Sherry? So that the whole idea that Sherry's going to get out through Skydance, but public shareholders are sort of stuck holding the bag. Like, just so many bad judgments going on here from a Paramount public shareholder point of view. It's hard to stop the list. And here's another one, getting rid of your CEO before you even know who's buying the company and whether they want to keep him or not.
It may not happen. I mean, things change, right? I mean, boards can change their mind. What do you think is going to happen to Paramount? I mean, and listen, a lot of our viewers are like, well, I don't own Paramount stock. I don't care. This is CBS, CBS News, CBS Sports, right? To your point, you mentioned Tom Cruise. He is Paramount at this point with Top Gun Maverick and one of the good friends of David Ellison, who runs Skydance, whose dad, by the way, is Larry Ellison of Oracle and one of the world's richest men. There's billions on the line and there's egos on the line.
Yeah, that's true. That's really true. Look, I think Bob Bakish has been sort of a yes man for Sherry, and she's doing Monday morning quarterbacking and saying, oh, now that we know that streaming actually doesn't work as an economic model, I'm really mad you didn't sell Showtime 5 years ago for $6 billion. You know, it's like completely ridiculous, these reasons she's giving to, like, these are tough jobs. Just watch Bob Iger over at Disney. These are just tough jobs right now because streaming didn't turn out to be the windfall we all thought it was going to be.
And we still got to figure out the streaming side. Completely understand that because I'm embroiled in it, right? It's my industry, and I would like them to make money on it. All right, Laura, I want to pivot a little bit to Apple. They've got their earnings next week. Stock had a good week. It was okay. It's been a tough year, but it did have a good week this week. What are you expecting to hear from Apple? We did some. I hosted the 3 o'clock Eastern Time show today, and we did something on IDC saying there could be a 10% drop in iPhone sales.
Right. So there's actually a really broad range of horrible numbers coming out of China for iPhone sales, as high as, I think Counterpoint says, iPhone unit sales might be down 17%. Somebody else came out different, but down 6%. It's all bad. So the point is, there's three things we're waiting to hear from Apple. One is core business, iPhone sales. That's their anchor tenant product that actually sort of gets people into their ecosystem, and then people add either services growth, which has a 60% margin, or other devices. The average iPhone user has two devices. So if you don't have that iPhone, you lost the device sale and you lost the services upside. So you really care about iPhone sales. And if China's falling off a cliff, A, where does it end? And B, like, how long is that going to be leaning on their revenue growth? So that is the most important thing, I think. Another really important thing is 80% of the commentary out of Alphabet and Meta was generative AI. And last quarter, this company didn't mention those words. They talked about the new iPhone color. So this notion that they're just ignoring like the tidal wave of the generative AI revolution, they need to actually address this and how they're going to use it in their business. Yeah. Because companies that use generative AI are going to win over companies that do not.
Yeah, and maybe in the phone somehow. I think and hope that Tim Cook and company are smarter than that, that maybe they're just biding their time. We may find out next week. Laura Martin, thank you. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Still ahead, circle the calendar. Manhattan congestion pricing now has a start date. And if you think this is just some boring old New York story, you're going to want to think again.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes has arrived in IMAX.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, now playing only in theaters. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
All right, welcome back. Well, many New Yorkers getting some news they're maybe not too happy about. Congestion pricing is set to officially begin in the Big Apple on June 30th. Once it starts, drivers will have to pay a $15 fee to drive into Manhattan anywhere south of 60th Street. That is from Midtown down to the lower tip of Manhattan. Keep in mind that is on top of the tolls to come in from New Jersey and effectively, for the first time ever, a new toll for people coming in from Queens or Brooklyn who right now can come in for free. It's the same state. Now, you're going to pay this toll by either getting your Easy Pass charged or the city will take a picture of your license plate and send you a bill. You know who is happy about this? Anybody who owns a parking garage north of 61st Street, their business is going to boom. There's a map, right? There are the locations. All those people, congratulations to you. You can probably double your rates and not have a drop-off in business. So cheers to them. Anyway, this is not just a New York story. Some cities like London and Singapore already have congestion pricing. And no doubt, other cities here in America, like Chicago, San Francisco, Boston, LA, et cetera, are going to keep a close eye on how this goes. And if it works here, raises money, cuts down on traffic, it could be coming to a city near you. Joining us now, Partnership for New York City President and CEO, Catherine Wild. Catherine, okay, I'm really torn about this. The last 2 days, I drove in. I had to because I was down at the New York Stock Exchange. Then I had to come here back to New Jersey. Took me 57 minutes to go 12 miles. Walkers, people with walkers were walking faster than I was driving. So I get the congestion's out of control. But you know, a lot of people are not happy about the money.
Well, excess congestion is not free. It's costing our city and our region more than $20 billion a year in lost productivity, wasted time like you had when you tried to drive in, and wasted fuel, environmental pollution, and health, asthma impacts. So we've got we've spent 20 years studying how do we solve the excess congestion problem. And as of June 30th, we're going to see what we can do by charging a toll for those people that do not have to drive in because we have public transit alternatives and we need to pay for them. Right now, the people who drive in to the city that pay tolls at the bridges, like you mentioned, whether it's from New Jersey or wherever, they're paying only 13% of the cost of the revenues for our mass transit system. 40% is paid by taxes on business and real estate, and 40% is paid by the riders, the people using the transit. We really have an opportunity here to balance that out so that the people who drive into the city and benefit from our thriving economy are contributing fairly, just yeah, like businesses.
But okay, so but here's the thing. Let's do the math. If you're somebody that's you live in, you know, suburbs of New Jersey and you want to come in on a Wednesday afternoon to see a show, you don't want to take the train because maybe you're just not that mobile, right? Maybe if you're older, you're going to be paying, I don't know, $10 on the New Jersey Turnpike toll. What is it? 17 to go through the Lincoln Tunnel. 15 for this, 50 to 70 to park. It's going to be like $100. just to get into the city. Are you worried that could damage business?
No, because this is a strong city. It's a magnet for people to come in, especially for those who are commuting to work, who are coming in to see Broadway. If you're coming in to see Broadway, you're paying $400 for a ticket. So let's face it, this is not really an imposition for $15 one way. If you come in after 9 p.m., it's $375. If you come through a tolled facility, a tunnel or a bridge, you get a substantial discount. So in fact, this is a matter of fairness. It will reduce congestion, reduce traffic, and so you'll be able to get to your show on time. You'll be able to have time for dinner. It will work in lots of ways. And for the business interests, it will really allow for our costs of doing business in the city are very high. Right now, we are losing money on overtime, on wasted fuel. We really need to do something about traffic congestion. It's one of the biggest complaints. Homelessness and traffic congestion in a recent survey of New Yorkers were the two biggest issues.
I'm not going to lie. The traffic is not good. I didn't want to drive in, but today, in fact, I parked in Hoboken and took the path over because I couldn't deal with another day like that. But we'll see what happens. June 30th, here it comes. Catherine Wilde laying it out. We appreciate it, Catherine. Have a good day and a great weekend.
Thank you.
All right, coming up, they say diamonds are forever. Or are they? Why our own Herb Greenberg is sounding the siren on diamond giant Signet. He is here next. Plus, is Tesla's autopilot safe? A major report just out, and you're going to want to hear it. We just never stop giving on this program. That is a bonus. Tomorrow's news tonight. Another regional bank, and a pretty big one, has just been seized by the FDIC. The bank is called Republic First Bank Corp. It is based in Philadelphia. They've got a few dozen branches across Pennsylvania, mostly southern New Jersey and New York. It's got a couple billion in assets and $4 billion in deposits. Now, the bank itself, it's got red signs. It says Republic Bank. It's not First Republic. It's Republic Bank. And it's being sort of forcibly sold to Fulton Bank. This is certainly not anywhere near the scale of Silicon Valley, Signature, or First Republic, but it is still another formerly, well, it's got a couple billion in assets, regional bank being seized and sold off. Herb Greenberg joining us now. Herb on the Street Substack, and he's got his deal and his new business. And we'll get to that in a second, Herb. And we brought you on to talk about diamonds and one company. But you're out there in San Diego, Silvergate Capital, more crypto firm. They failed. This is not a huge deal, but I don't think it's nothing. You got to take?
Well, I just saw the story and just went through it real quickly. And what you basically can say on this is, look, every regional bank, they're not all created equally. And some are more challenged than others, especially with higher interest rates and the need to pay depositors more. That's one of the big issues at this company. But I think what you have to look at is that, you know, in this case, it's very interesting. There was an acquirer, whether it was forced or not. Of course, New York Community Bank was an acquirer of a troubled bank.
Yeah.
And we know what happened there. But I think you also will see others taking advantage of this situation. So look, I'm not the banking expert du jour, but I can tell you that that one thing I do know is I will continue to say, and I've said since we started talking about Silicon Valley Bank here, it is a bank by bank situation. And you know, you've got to look at it like that. That said, you go to look at the regional bank index, I'm sure on Monday, that will be impacted by this just by nature of the sheer nature of the knee-jerk reaction that we typically see.
Yeah, you wonder if it's a reaction to this big spike in interest rates that we've had the last couple of weeks. I doubt it. We got to dig in more. Appreciate your comment. But we knew you could, Herb. We never worry about you. Here's why you're on, though. You just issued a big red flag alert on Signet. That is the parent company. Everybody knows the mall-based jewelry stores like Zales and Jared's. He went to Jared's, right? Signet Jewelers, stock soaring. It's up 35%, but you're worried about something here. What is it?
Well, you know, it's interesting. And this is a company I followed on and off for years, even when I was doing short research. And I just recently wrote about this and did a red flag alert at Wall Street Beach, which is my new home. And the situation is this. This is a company that has actually done very well coming out of a very troubled situation a number of years ago. Its stock tumbled 50% because of a variety of issues. It came back, it went through COVID, it had some issues, but it's now challenged with something else, and that is the growth of lab-grown diamonds. A lot of people didn't really see this one coming, because if you go back even to 2018, this company did not sell lab-grown diamonds. They're now 12% of sales. You know, whether you call them fake diamonds, people will tell you they look like real diamonds, and they are grabbing a bigger and bigger share, perhaps 20% of the retail diamond business. Signet is the largest retail jeweler with 2,800 stores in the U.S. and the U.K. And so the impact is they're getting the prices on these have just come way down. That has caused great disarray in the diamond industry. The diamond, natural diamond prices have come down. You see, you know, talk that Anglo American is going to sell, wants to potentially sell De Beers, which is a diamond miner, partially because of some of the issues going on in the diamond industry. As this relates to Signet, here's the important thing. As prices of all diamonds come down, Signet's real money is made on its extended service agreements. These are the, you know, ESAs, the service plans they sell when they sell a piece of jewelry. They are sold based on the price of the purchase. As the prices come down, they have to sell more, regardless if it's natural diamonds or fake diamonds, and they have to run in place, up that down escalator faster, just to stay in place. That impacts margins, potentially cash flow. This is something you must watch going forward with this company. Company insists it's got it all under control. I suggest there's an issue here that will rear its head in coming quarters.
Yeah, I never thought about it. So it's in your way, very quickly, it's kind of almost like an insurance play a little bit, this service agreement.
No, it's like buying an insurance. It's like getting a repair plan, an extended service plan on my MacBook. It's the same thing. And it's based on the price of what you pay.
And if the MacBook goes down in price because there's now a synthetic MacBook, then the price of the service agreement goes down.
It's exactly. Look, it's to clean the diamond, make sure that the diamonds aren't loose, that type of thing, getting them checked. That's all part of something like an extended service plan like this on jewelry. So this is, and again, the company itself says that these are a significant portion of their operating income and a big part of their margins. That's why you have to pay attention. There's a lot of disarray going on right now in that industry, and they are smack dab in the middle of it.
Who knew? I was going to call this segment fake diamond news, but might be too, well, you know, I can't do that. Herb Greenberg.
Don't do that.
No, I just did, though. Signet, we're watching them. Herb, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, next up, if you own a Tesla, Herb probably has eight, you might want to pay attention. After a three-year investigation, federal authorities just issued a new report. It says that Tesla's autopilot system has a, quote, critical safety gap. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration analyzed 956 crashes involving Tesla's autopilot. They found the software contributed to at least 467 collisions and, sadly, 13 fatalities. They write, quote, Tesla's weak driver engagement system was not appropriate for autopilot's permissive operating capabilities, whatever that means. And this gap led to foreseeable misuse and avoidable crashes. Tesla stock initially took a bit of a tumble on that news, but let's try to figure out more here. Let's bring in CNBC tech reporter Laura Kolodny on this. She's been writing about it. And I want to be clear. First off, this is not full self-driving, correct? This is autopilot, which is just more of a driver assist. It's not driving the car for you.
Well, Tesla doesn't make a driverless vehicle or any system that's safe to use without a human, you know, ready to steer or brake at any time. So it is driver assist. The features in autopilot are included in, you know, the full slate. It's things like traffic aware cruise control and auto steer.
I'm going through the numbers and it was 950. I'm doing it off my head because they're gone in the prompter. 956 and 467. So it sounded about half worse of these wrecks. And there we go. Thank you, guys. 467 collisions, 13 fatal crashes. But they analyzed 956 accidents. So it's about half. Do we know how many of these were human error, Laura, where people were overestimating or overusing this autopilot, where they need to actively pay attention?
They are supposed to actively pay attention. And what NHTSA found is that the way autopilot is designed had an effect where people weren't using it correctly. They would become, you know, sort of complacent, like zoned out, and not stay attentive to the driving task or attentive to the road, not keep their hands on the wheel as they should. So they're saying that Tesla's driver engagement system, which is the system, you know, that sends nags, chimes, alerts the driver when they're not engaged enough, that's probably deficient. And actually, Tesla issued a recall, one of their software recalls, for this last year in December. And now NHTSA is investigating whether that was inadequate.
Yeah,
it seems inadequate because there have been more fatal crashes since.
Yeah, but I do wonder if you know, Blue Cruise and Ford's thing and GM's thing and Volvo's thing, I wonder if there's similar numbers there. I don't know. Maybe we're digging into that as well, but it's an interesting report and a little scary. Pay attention. Laura Kolodny, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, coming up, a huge move by the EPA that almost nobody else is talking about that could impact your home electricity prices. But of course, we're last call, so we're talking about it next. There you go. Time for tonight's RBI, and we're talking energy because something is happening with natural gas and oil that we have not seen in a long time. This was spotted by our friends at Bespoke. Rising output and sluggish demand has led to a relentless fall in natural gas prices, down more significantly over the past year. It's tanked. But when you look at oil over that span, a bit of a different story. In the same time frame, oil prices up 12%. Now, it's a little unusual because they often move in the same direction. Natural gas is, after all, a byproduct of drilling and producing oil. And that's what makes this recent divergence so intriguing. Check this out. Oil is now trading at 51.7 times the price of natural gas. Since 1990, oil has only traded at a ratio of 50 or higher once before in April of 2012, and that only lasted for 12 days. Wow. So what happened back then? Well, within the next 2 months, the price of oil dropped nearly 20%, and natural gas went up nearly 10%. Of course, that could happen again or not, or they could keep diverging. So just a reminder, if you see that data and you say, well, it's going to flip, be careful if you try to trade it, because I don't need to remind you that the boys in the pits call trading on natural gas the widowmaker. And there's a reason. A lot of people lose a lot of money on it. It's random but interesting, but be careful out there. All right, staying with energy, there's quietly been some big news this week that might have an impact on your future home electricity bill. The Environmental Protection Agency is finalizing new rules that would greatly limit carbon emissions from power plants. It would require all long-term coal-fired power plants and all new natural gas-fired power plants to cut greenhouse emissions by 90%. Proponents say it would be great news for the environment, as harmful emissions would be limited. But there is also some concern that it could raise costs on these plants, which, of course, then would get passed on to you and your home electricity bill. So let's try to figure out exactly what is going on, why it matters. Joining us now is former assistant administrator of the U.S. EPA for Air and Radiation and partner and co-head of Environmental Strategies Group at Bracewell, Jeff Homestead. Jeff, it's a little complicated. Listen, these are rules. They're being finalized. They're kind of wonky. It's in the weeds. So it's a hard story to tell in like 4 minutes, but let's try to do it. In your view, what do they mean?
So you have to remember, this is the third time that that the administration has tried to do these rules to regulate CO2 emissions from power plants. The Biden administration did its Clean Power Plan. The Trump administration did something called the Affordable Energy Act. And this is by far the most aggressive one that we've seen yet. The agency admits that it will have an impact on power prices. They claim it will be electricity prices. They claim it will be modest. But I think a lot of folks in the industry are skeptical about those claims.
Yeah, it's the end. Now, to be fair, as you know, Jeff, and I don't need to tell you this, the industry is always going to complain. Anytime there's a new regulation, every industry, it's going to destroy this, it's going to destroy that. We want to reduce harmful emissions. We don't want bad stuff in our water or our air. We get that. 90%, though, seems like a huge number. Is that even possible to capture that amount of carbon emissions from an old coal plant?
So it's technically possible. There's a lot of questions about whether it can be done throughout the industry. I mean, if you choose one plant and you spend a lot of money on it, we do have an example of one plant that is doing this in the United States. But this rule requires basically all coal-fired power plants that want to operate beyond 2039 to install carbon capture and sequestration, which is really largely unproven at anything like this scale. And there's no gas-fired power plant anywhere in the world that actually captures its CO2 emissions. So EPA claims that the technology is there. They can't point to any place where it's being done. But it will be a tall order to try to capture 90% of the emissions from these plants.
So it's a moonshot. But again, we do need some moonshots to kind of encourage people. I just wonder if you're running an old coal plant. I know people think coal's dead. No, we're using more coal than we've ever used in American history, or at least close to it. Do you say, I can't afford it? I can't do it. It's not possible. I'm shutting down, because we're going to have a massive power shortage already with all the AI and data centers coming out. I mean, massive.
Yeah, that's a huge concern. As you know, demand for electricity has been pretty steady for more than a decade now, but all of a sudden we're seeing huge jumps. And I think people are very concerned about providing enough electricity for all the demands, including EPA's new rules for electric vehicles, which will also increase demand for electricity. So there's no doubt mm-hmm. that it will be a challenge. The one thing I would say, though, is there's a very good chance that this rule will not withstand scrutiny in the courts. EPA has tried to be aggressive here. Yeah. We know we have a Supreme Court that's been skeptical about that. And so I think the jury is still out on whether these rules will actually come into place or not.
Yeah. Only people that ever get rich are the lawyers. We know that. Jeff, thank you very much. Really appreciate your time. Interesting story. Important, too. Thank you.
No, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Oh, very much. All right. Coming up, why is the Wall Street Journal's Joanna Stern dropping perfectly good iPhones from the sky? A jaw-dropping report you're going to see next. Well, the Wall Street Journal's weather forecast this weekend is apparently cloudy with a chance of iPhones. Kidding. But all jokes aside, their fabulous personal technology columnist, Joanna Stern, did just put out a new piece investigating how the one iPhone, remember that, survived the Alaska Airlines door plug blowout a few months ago. Joanna joining us now with the findings of dropping Samsung and iPhones from a variety of heights. It's not only a fascinating technology piece, Joanna, it's also a physics lesson in disguise.
It is, Brian. This is it. This is journalism at its finest. But as you said, there was only one thing to be done after I found out that that phone flew from 16,000 feet in the air out that Alaska Airlines door plug and lands on the ground perfectly fine. How did that happen? And the answer is actually one word. It's grass. Or soft surfaces, because after throwing all these phones off of a drone at 300 feet, and we can get into the physics of why 300 feet is actually a lot like 16,000 feet when it comes to falling objects, the phones that fell on asphalt completely smashed, even in a case. The phones that fell on grass survived.
Yeah, and this is what's cool about your piece, not only is that we're watching the videos now, and I urge everybody to go check it out because your producer also made the contraption that enabled the thing to drop, is that everybody out there watching and listening has probably nudged their phone off of their kitchen counter. It falls 3 feet and the screen cracks. And you're just like, what in the world? How does the phone survive 16,000 or 300 feet?
This was exactly what I set out to answer, right? Last year, a friend of mine and my family members' phones broke from just sliding off the car. That's something that's known to happen. And the reason for that, well, there's two reasons for that. One is the surface it lands on, but two is the angle that it lands on. And this is a little bit where the physics lesson comes in, because there is the contact area. And if you're hitting that phone on the edge and it lands very hard on an edge, there's probably a good chance that screen is going to shatter because of the pressure hitting that edge. Mm. One thing that I wouldn't say this was a very scientific test here, but one thing that I did notice is that the Samsung phones, and again, we didn't have any really control of how the phones landed. Well, zero control, really. But the Samsung phones tended to land on their edges. And in the case of the Samsung phones, they got destroyed a lot more. One just completely didn't work. The iPhones definitely had smashed glass, but the phones themselves worked. And I had a feeling it could be because of how they landed.
Wow. So I think we've also learned, not only do we learn about the concept of terminal velocity, I got a D+ in physics, by the way, in high school, but we learned that apparently Samsung phones or either are edge heavy or just bad luck, at least in this situation. Joanna Stern, really cool piece. Great. That's actual reporting. It's amazing. Joanna, thank you. Folks, thank you all for watching or listening, or maybe listening to the podcast later. Have a great weekend. We'll see you Monday. Shark Tank is next.
I won't let my active psoriatic arthritis joint symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. Tremfya guselkumab is proven to significantly reduce joint pain, stiffness, and swelling in adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Some patients even reported less fatigue as assessed by survey 1 week prior. Results may vary. Tremfya is taken by injection 6 times a year after 2 starter doses at week 0 and 4.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cause support may be available.